Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start out with the Mojo interview, and this is with Red Hot Chili Peppers bass player Flea. Then, the rise of the Hold Steady Band. And a classic album review of Under the Table and Dreaming by the Dave Matthews Band. And here is the Mojo interview. A turbulent childhood, redeemed by jazz, resurfaces on a first solo album by the Red Hot Chili Peppers all-action bass player. A break from the goofy funk rock norm? I was reaching for something beautiful, always, says Flea. On a sunny winter's morning, high in the Hollywood Hills, Mojo's Uber comes to a halt by a gated road. While the driver figures out how to get to the other side, a man wearing shorts, t-shirt, and a big smile appears out of nowhere. It's Flea, back from his morning run. 63 years old, sober for the last 30. He's as wiry, compact, and intense as he ever was, with a seemingly indeflatable energy. I run in the wild places up here, he says, as we walk down the long lane that leads to the house where he lives with his wife and their 3-year-old son. None of the easy paths for Flea. I go to places people don't know about, he tells Mojo. Thinking about it, it's what he's done his whole life. Born Michael Peter Balzri in Melbourne in 1962, he acquired the nickname Mike B. the Flea in school. By the age of 4, he was living in New York, where his father worked for the Australian consulate. When he was 6, his dad moved back to Australia without him, his mother having taken up with Walter Urban, a junky jazz musician. By the time Flea was 10, the family was on the other side of the country in Los Angeles. A year later, he was living like a street kid, doing drugs, looking out for himself. In his early 20s, more than 4 decades ago, he co-founded the Red Hot Chili Peppers with schoolmate Anthony Kiedis and the late Hillel Slovak. Guitarists and drummers didn't always stick around, although today's Red Hot Chili Pepper lineup with Chad Smith on drums and the mercurial John Frusciante on guitar can lay a fair claim to being definitive. I've never lived in a place as grand as this, Flea says, of the house he bought 5 years ago. Something in his voice suggests he's still surprised at how his life turned out. The Chili Peppers spent many years living in squats and crack-dealing houses. Tours meant sharing motel beds, sleeping head to foot with Chad's stinky feet. Their frantic mix of punk and funk marked them out on a mid-80s L.A. music scene dominated by hair metal. And it wasn't until 1991 and Blood Sugar Sex Magik that they made it to platinum. Since then, a pivot towards pop has made the group more enormous still. At the same time, Flea's side projects attest to a questing bent. The musician who filled in for L.A. punk band Fear in 1982-83 has played with Johnny Cash, Thom Yorke, Atoms for Peace, Damon Albarn, Rocket Juice and the Moon, The Bad Seeds, Warren Ellis, Tom Waits, and Patti Smith. While acting in dozens of movies, including a memorable turn as a Teutonic nihilist in The Big Lebowski. "I'm a cinephile," he concedes, as we settle in his private screening room, where he comes every day to watch films and listen to records. "I sit here by myself, listening and watching," he says. "I try to leave my phone in the other room." Flea's latest release is his first solo album, a jazz record called Anora, and a return to his first instrument, the trumpet. Excusing himself, Flea closes his eyes and says a silent prayer. And the Mojo interview begins. When did music first come into your life? I was 6 years old, looking at my dad's records, Johnny Cash, Live at Folsom Prison, a Pete, Paul and Mary record, a Nina Simone album. I remember hearing the records, but I couldn't touch them. It was this thing for grown-ups. I knew it was something serious. But it's like when you're a kid and you hear about sex, but you have no idea what it is. It all sounds crazy but fascinating. You want to know about it, but it's a complete mystery. And I was so in awe of the mystery. I looked at the records and I knew that it was something I longed for and I needed to know. It was a feeling that stuck with me forever. I still feel that way. You were living in New York, but your dad moved back to Australia. Yeah, my father left when I was 6 or 7 years old, and my stepfather came into the picture, and there was music everywhere. My real father wasn't like a real music guy. He had records that he liked, and he had cocktail parties. But my stepfather was a musician. He had jam sessions at the house, people playing live in my living room. I was in awe. When my mom got with my stepfather, that was when I really heard jazz and fell in love with music. I remember I got this John Thompson piano instruction book, and I sat at the piano by myself, just figuring it out with the book, playing simple little melodies, sings Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, not with any discipline or regularity, but being there. I didn't get music in school until I got to junior high school, and that was when they gave me a trumpet, and I started playing it. I was 11. Did you take the trumpet immediately? Did you take to the trumpet immediately? I was absolutely in love with that trumpet. I thought it was the most beautiful thing I ever saw, but I was wildly undisciplined. By the time I was 11, I was out in the street all day, running around getting crazy, so I didn't have the discipline to sit and practice. I think the thing that really helped me with it was that even though I didn't begin studying music before I became an adult, I knew what beautiful was. I listened to records like Louis Armstrong, and I cried because it was so beautiful. So when I would blow the thing, I was reaching for something beautiful, always. What were the first records you owned? Louis Armstrong and the Beatles? At that time, I really liked the Beatles. The Beatles had horns on their records, so I assumed that the Beatles played the horns themselves. I didn't understand anything about studio musicians or who did what. I remember I used to put my school trumpet on my bed, a cornet, really, the one that ended up giving me cold sores on my lips because we all passed it around so much at school, because I thought the Beatles would have their trumpets on the bed too. I would walk out of the room and come back in, pick up my trumpet, and pretend that I was in the Beatles. I have a little son, 3 years old, and he loves the Beatles. In my life, John Lennon's Imagine, Beautiful Boy, Come Together. He'll be having a tantrum or something, and the opening salvo of Let It Be would come on, and he'll just stop and stare into space as it's doing this magical thing to his little psyche. How good were you on trumpet? I was pretty good. I won a prize for playing it. People at school, because I was little and shy, were like, "Oh, that's Michael. He plays the trumpet, and he plays basketball every day." They were the vehicles for me to define myself with back then, and they're the things I still love. In your memoir, Acid for the Children, 2019, you described a childhood that was bohemian, but also brutal. It was bohemian in a way that my stepdad was a jazz musician, very arrogant and born with the feeling that real musicians weren't getting work. He fixed cars in the backyard to make a buck, and my mom always worked full-time as a secretary. But it was also overshadowed by violence and fear. My stepdad was very violent and abusive, terrifying. I had a rug in the garage, and I would roll myself in the rug and go to sleep because I was scared to sleep in the house. I didn't know what was going to happen. The cops would come. There would be guns. It wasn't good. Obviously, home should be a sanctuary for a child, a place to escape the insanity of the world. I feel grateful now to have the opportunity to create that for my children, or at least try to. My stepfather was a bass player, upright bass, and the way he played it was very aggressive physically. He would pound the shit out of the thing, and he would be in a rage, gripping this thing, going crazy yelling. So I kind of equated that with the way he was. Surprising, then, that you'd take up bass. Well, I wanted to be a trumpet player, but I started playing bass in a rock band, which he really looked down on. Was that when Hill Slovak asked you to join his band? Yeah, and 2 weeks later, I'm on Sunset Strip, posing and being a rock star, and all of a sudden, girls are talking to me. I thought I was just going to completely against my stepfather because he frowned on me for playing punk rock and rock music, which he thought was ridiculous and had nothing to do with music. It was only recently after I wrote my book that I started to understand how exactly like him I was in a way that I played, because it has always been all this anger and fear and anxiety. I played so aggressively, and so much of it was what I learned from him subconsciously, that the instrument is a vehicle for getting out your anger and your fear and your feelings of not being understood. Obviously, you grow and change, and it becomes a vehicle for all different types of life, an expression of love and tenderness and connection, as well as anger and anxiety. But I didn't know for so long that this had been what he showed me. That was an awakening for me. There's a real tenderness at times on your jazz album. I guess I've come to a place in my life where I'm not scared to show that anymore, in truth, for a long time now. I still see the value of loud, aggressive art, but there's also something that's unabashedly loving, sweet, and tender, and I embrace it. A happy event from your early childhood was your mom taking you to a Dizzy Gillespie concert. Dizzy Gillespie was my hero. My mom and I were in the audience waiting for him to come on, and I have to go pee. I don't want to miss the show, so I jump up and I run left to right, and I open a door, and there he was. And all of a sudden, I stopped thinking about peeing. I just ran up to him and went, "Oh, Mr. Gillespie." I was just a little kid. I couldn't get a word out. He was talking to somebody, and he just pulled me in and held me. He tugged me into his rib cage with his arm around me while he continued the conversation. And I was there, feeling his suit, smelling his cologne, just listening to the sound of his voice and thinking, "Oh my God, this is the center of the universe where all the magic is. Will you please be my dad?" When he finished talking, he patted my head and he walked on stage and started playing "Night in Tunisia." I ran back. I can't remember the peeing anymore, just the smell of his suit and the smile and hug I had from him. Fast forward to Bruce Weber's great 1988 documentary, Let's Get Lost, in which you discuss trumpet playing with Chet Baker. What did you make of Baker? Well, it's funny. Every morning, I have my morning record with my coffee, and this morning, it was Chet Baker Sings. I grew up loving Chet Baker. I've not really watched the documentary. I've seen clips of me on the beach, hamming it up, and I always cringe when I see it. I'm embarrassed by myself. The thing I remember most was talking to Chet about Clifford Brown. I started singing Joy Spring, a beautiful, beautiful song that Clifford Brown did with Max Roach. That I've loved since I was a little boy. And Chet Baker, sitting at the table, started singing it with me. Here's a little bit of that song, Joy Spring, by Clifford Brown. You got to work with another of your childhood heroes, Johnny Cash, playing bass on his American 2 Unchained album, 1996. What do you remember? Just listening to him sing and play and being blown away. I think I started crying just from that feeling of being around a force of nature when he was singing. His sound and his power was just unbelievable. He was this old guy, and he sat down, and it was so powerful. Such a lesson that it's all about that inner strength and that desire and that sense of commitment and belief and love in what you're doing. And that you can do that as an old guy, it made me cry. The thing of being open to a spiritual power. How did you and Anthony Kiedis meet? Well, we had just turned 15. It was the beginning of a school year, and we had just gotten to high school. So we were all new. Anthony had been in LA for a few years, just like me. He was an immediate presence. He had his hair cut really short. I remember him saying he held a gun to your head that first day of school. A gun? Well, I think he was being a metaphorical, but the first time he met me, he did threaten me. There was this other kid who was my friend, and I was kind of being an asshole. I had the kid in a headlock and doing what we call in Los Angeles a noogie, which is when you grind your knuckles into someone's head. I was doing it playfully, but I don't think he appreciated it. And Anthony was shouts, "Lay off him!" He physically threatened me to let go of that kid. I was like, "Who is this guy?" Very shortly after that, Anthony and I had classes together, and we became inseparable friends. What did the two of you have in common? Music? Not really. He came from a complete different world. He lived with his father, who was kind of like a Hollywood playboy, actor, wild man, Blackie Dammit. And Anthony knew about rock music and early punk rock and new wave and shit that was happening through his dad, who was in the Hollywood scene. But I didn't know anything about that. I had my trumpet. So he kind of exposed me to that world, the excitement of it. My mother said, I came home from school very serious and said, Mom, I finally found someone I can talk to. Is it still like that? Well, on occasion, but not like we were. We don't see each other as much. Time has definitely... We've grown in different directions in some ways. But we always love each other. He's my brother. What were you like as school kids? Neither of us came from well-to-do families, to say the least. And there's that thing when you have nothing and all you have is each other, running around the streets together. We were always hustling together in the street. How are we going to get some food? Can we get into a movie somehow? Anything we wanted to do, the stupid little crimes that we did. And drugs? Doing drugs? Yeah, I started getting high when I was about 11. Stupid. Because of that, it took me a long time to become emotionally mature. With Hillel, you and Anthony became a threesome. What did Hillel mean to you? Well, for our band, everything. He was the one who asked me to start playing the bass. I would never have played bass without him. And without him, I would never have been in a rock band. He taught me so much. When Anthony and I met him, we were young. We were out hitchhiking the street, and we saw him, and he had a car. He was fucking 16, and he had a car, a Datsun 510. He had a stereo in the car, and he was smoking weed and listening to Zeppelin. He gave us a ride, and I think he gave us some weed. He showed me Jimi Hendrix and Jeff Beck, and then the Gang of Four, all this stuff. What was it about him? I looked up to him. I was in love with him. He was a beautiful boy and troubled, like all of us were. Difficulties at home, difficulties everywhere. His guitar playing was beautiful. His hair, the way he dressed, everything. A beautiful friend. And really sadly, a drug addict, heroin. And he didn't make it through. At that time, it was touch and go for all of us. Any one of us, it could have been who died. It was a real tragedy for us and his family. His death in 1988 came when things were looking up for you. Married, a kid coming, a breakthrough Chili's album with the Uplift Mofo Party Plan. Well, it was devastating, just unbelievable. When it happened, I was so shocked, I just fell on the floor, gasping for air. But as far as the band was concerned at that time, I didn't really care. The band has always sort of taken care of itself. It wasn't like, are we going to break up or not? Whatever happened, I knew I was going to play music. And however it was going to manifest itself, it was going to manifest. People ask, how did the band go on so long? Something would always present itself, and we'd say, that's cool, let's do it. He brought in John Frusciante. What did he add to the Chili Peppers? A different sensibility of music, that melodic sense and knowledge of chord progressions that, mixed with the more funky, rhythmic thing that we had, created the sound of the Chili Peppers that became huge. How exactly did your solo album come about? Well, the idea started about 2 years before I made the record. I decided I was going to practice trumpet every day for 2 years, and at the end of the 2 years, I was going to make a record playing trumpet no matter what. The Chili Peppers went on the road for 2 years, and I played the trumpet every day in the hotel room, in the closet, no matter what, every day. I got a teacher, Ricky Washington, father of saxophonist Kamal, who started teaching me stuff like how to look at chords. He gave me things to practice, and I'd practice in my room. Making a jazz record for the first time, what went through your mind? Your stepdad? Well, it wasn't that I felt I had to be allowed to do it, but I went back and forth between knowing I have a story to tell and complete fear and insecurity, like I'm not good enough. In the beginning, I was thinking of doing the whole album by myself, playing trumpet, bass, synthesizer. And then I started thinking about having musicians. At first, I was scared they'd all be so much better than me. But the musicians were all so free of ego and really connected to me in a sincere, beautiful way. They moved me to tears many times. Since we recorded the record, which was last February, I still play every day. What did the Chili Peppers make of it? Well, I played it for Chad and for other friends. Chad plays at the beginning and on another song. I played it for John, who also worked on it, but I hadn't played it for Anthony. I didn't know if he would want to hear it or not. I didn't really know where he was at with it, but I had a record listening event in LA and invited him, and he came, and yeah, I think he really liked it. How did Tom York get involved? Well, I didn't intend to have anybody singing on it at all, but we were listening back and I thought Tom's voice would really resonate here. I love Radiohead, and I really loved York's solo album, The Eraser, 2006. It might be the one I go to the most when I want to hear Tom. He put together a band, Atoms for Peace, to tour that record and ask me to be part of it. I was so excited, and it was so fun when we did it. So it was like, let's do our own record, Amok 2013. I thought we could have done better on that. But regardless, we were friends, and we played together and jammed together a lot. And you have Nick Cave singing Wichita Lineman. Well, I thought it could be a great instrumental standard. Then, when I was listening back to it, I remember Nick saying how much he loved Jimmy Webb. I know Nick a little bit. It's not like we're close or anything, but I sent him the track late at night in the UK, and he responded in like 30 minutes. Yeah, this is so beautiful. I'm leaving on a tour in a couple of days. I'm going to have to do it right away. And the day after next, this thing came in an email. And here's a little bit of that song, Wichita Lineman, with Flea and Nick Cave.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the wine, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if Christ.
Was Nick atoning for what he once told Q Magazine? I'm forever near a stereo saying, "What the fuck is this garbage?" And the answer is always the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Laughs. I mean, of course. I would rather him think we were soulful geniuses, but I understand. Nick suggested that you're a bear whisperer. What's that all about? Nick and I share a mutual friend who might be my best friend in the world, an artist from Leeds. Thomas, how's it go? Thomas and I had my daughter and Pete Staley, another friend, went on a backpacking trip in Yosemite a couple of years ago. We went way out into the backcountry, which is one of my favorite things to do, and we'd been talking about maybe we'd see a bear, but a little scared too because it could kill you. So we're walking down this thickly wooded trail, the big river on one side, and I was in the front, and then, boom, there's a giant bear right in front of me. Without thinking, I said to the bear, "Bear, I love you. I love you so much. Thanks for having us in your beautiful place. I'm so pleased to see you. May we pass?" And the bear just kind of looked and then ambled off into the woods. So you lived to make a trumpet album. Will you make a second one? Well, in a way, I can't wait to make another one because I'm getting so much better at the trumpet. I feel like I'm really starting to get there. But though I didn't know what this album would be exactly, it was exactly what I wanted it to be. But it's all a learning experience. The next one will grow. Do you feel the same way about another Chili Peppers album? Well, it's like being in a marriage with four people that's always moving and changing, all these challenges and all the things that you have to deal with. Egos are inescapable, and my ego is as big and as fragile as anybody's. But it's always, no matter what, this intrinsic part of who I am, and it's alive and it's beautiful. And you never know what shape it's going to take next. I really feel like that right now. We've been writing music together, recording at John's house, and the music feels great. Ultimately, once we start playing, it's about the same thing, just catching a magic groove and doing it good. Okay, here's a side article, 1-2 Flea. The Essential Albums by Sylvie Simmons. The Funky Juggernaut. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic. Written and recorded in the old mansion in Laurel Canyon, where Houdini once lived, with Rick Rubin producing, the band's fifth album was their breakthrough, their first to go platinum. Songs ranged from the tight, funky supergroove of Give It Away to the unexpectedly introspective Under the Bridge, as well as a wild acoustic skiffle cover of Robert Johnson's They're Red Hot, recorded under the stars at 3 a.m., Flea's idea. And here's a little bit of the song Give It Away by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And here's a little bit of the song Under the Bridge from the same album, Blood Sugar Sex Magic.
Sometimes I feel like my only friend is the city I live in, the city of angels. Lonely as I am, together we cry. Streets, 'cause she's my companion.
And the redemptive rocker, Californication. Despite the success, the vibe around Red Hot Chili Pepper was pretty dark. The drugs and motorbike accident didn't help, nor did having to swap ravaged guitarist John Fuscanade for Dave Navarro. But Fuscanade, now sober, was back for their seventh album. Working on Flea's garage studio, they came out with some of their deepest, most mature, and varied songs. The best record I think the Chili Peppers have ever made, Flea told Mojo. It sold 15 million copies. And here's the song Californication off the album of the same name, by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Next up is the Mojo Eyewitness, the rise of the Hold Steady. Literate heartland rockers from Minnesota via Brooklyn, they first turned heads with 2005's Separation Sunday. Then East Street-style crossover was theirs with 2006's Mighty Boys and Girls in America. 20 years on, the band reflect on romantic America, waxed mustaches, dissolving marriages, and a 24-hour party. We went from scrappy indie to a full rock presentation, they recalled, and we weren't afraid to embrace the grandiosity of that. Craig Finn. Our second album, Separation Sunday, 2005, had blown things open for us in the States. I did interview after interview. We were excited, with a real commitment to being on the road. But that put some of our personal lives in turmoil. I had been married, but that marriage didn't make it to Boys and Girls in America. Ted Kubler. Craig and I had been in post-punk lifter-puller together back in Minneapolis, where everybody around us was a friend with the Hold Steady. You'd walk on stage to a packed crowd, and I'd be like, guys, I don't know any of these people. Do you? It was obvious. We were clawing our way to another level. Bobby Drake. The shows were getting bigger, but we were still driving around in this square box truck, this dangerous old removals van with a loose couch rolling around. I had to drill a hole on top and put an extractor fan in. It got pretty gnarly back there. Galen Polvica. The lion's share of the prep for Boys and Girls was done at our space in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which was across the road from this hipster bar called the Pencil Factory. There was a lot of drinking while we waited for whoever was missing to show up. But it was all very relaxed. Craig, Boys and Girls was the first record where Franz, Nick Lay, keyboardist, was completely integrated into the writing. For us, rock guys, having his piano was really exciting. You could have these drops in the bridges, like our heroes, the E Street Band. It got kind of baroque and dramatic. And here's a little bit of the song, Stuck Between Stations, by The Rocksteady.
America, they're such a sad time together, sucking off each other at the demonstrations, making sure they make us straight, crushing one another with colossal expectations, depending on discipline, sleep and wait. She was a really cool kisser, and she wasn't all that strict of a Christian. She was a damn good dancer, but she wasn't all that great of a girl.
A clutter. My first thought on hearing the Hold Steady was, I did not know Bruce Springsteen had a tribute band doing The Damned, but I liked it. Craig. John and Jello had seen us at Austin, Texas Music Festival, SXSW, and had expressed an interest in working with us even before we made Separation Sunday. John Agnello. Correct. But there was no conversation at SXSW. Me and my wife just stumbled across them, and we were like, holy cow! Bobby, we were 24-hour party people, carrying on like a bunch of freaks. Lots of Jim Beam and 200-plus shows a year. Friends was swinging from a wine bottle and was swiggling from a wine bottle, and Craig was doing all this Craig stuff. Animated gesticulation, pogoing, finger pointing, general crowd cheerleading, which was highly entertaining. Later on, I got a call about doing Boys and Girls in America, and I was like, I'm a huge fan, I'd love to. Craig. Our initial meeting with John went really well. We talked about how great Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak is. Later on, I remember him playing me 4% Pantomime by the band and Van Morrison and saying, listen, see how precise Van's phrasing is? John made me feel like a real musician for the first time in my life, that I actually had a job. That was profound for me. We had a production meeting with Tony Visconti, too. After Boys and Girls came out, we played on Jules Holland later, and Tony was a guest. Jules asked him if he knew anybody else there, and he said, well, I know these guys. We talked about making a record together. I wanted to hide. We love Thin Lizzy's stuff and storytelling. Phil Lynott was such a romantic, Springsteen-esque character. Plus, growing up in the American Midwest, classic rock radio was in our bloodstream. We were coming from a 90s indie rock background where guys in tight pants were kind of frowned upon. But we didn't care. We liked the bombacity indie. It's just as ripe for parody anyway. Dana. In the studio, I was assigned to Franz and his waxed mustache, really. We were both classically trained piano players. So, if he said Allegro con brio, I understood. Galen. Franz's contribution was gigantic. We went from scrappy indie to a full rock presentation, and we weren't afraid to embrace the grandiosity of that. Craig, the LP title is a line from Kerouac's On the Road. When I first read the book, age 15 or 16, it went over my head, but I was revisiting it in my early 30s while we were working on the record. If I remember right, the book's narrator, Sal Paradise, wants to make out with this girl, but she says no, and he says, boys and girls in America have such a sad time together. My marriage was dissolving, and I was struck by that line. There's something overly dramatic and funny about it. It's like something Morrissey would say. Dana, Craig Finn and I read the same poets, John Berryman and Delmore Swartz. The Hold Steady were also kind of enamored with Charles Bulowski and Kerouac. But as a woman, I hate Bukowski. I think for them, the Bukowski aspect had a lot to do with excessive alcohol. Craig went to Boston College, which is a very Catholic Jesuit school, and I had lived in Boston too. Craig was familiar to me as a type, the I'm going to walk around and drink some more type. Franz Nicolay. Craig kept his lyrics pretty close to his chest, and it was so loud in the rehearsal room that we couldn't really hear them. He'd have these sheaves of paper scribbling away. Then you'd hear his lyrics in the studio, and they'd have inside jokes for us, little Easter eggs. Dad, that unveiling process could be really intense, because what Craig does is so unique and polarizing. It was, hang on, what did he just say? Craig, Separation Sunday has a narrative arc, but Boys and Girls doesn't really. It's not in my best interest to spell it all out anyway. I was spending a lot of time in bars, taking in stories, but I was also very open to getting things out of my own life and into the songs. I went to the horse races in Saratoga, New York, with my sister and her friends, and I thought, what if there was a woman who could see which horse would finish first? That's where Chips Ahoy came from. Here's a little bit of that song, Chips Ahoy, by the Hold Steady.
She put $900 on the fifth horse. I think his name was Chips Ahoy. He came in six lengths ahead. We spent the whole next week getting high. At first I thought that she hit on some chip that she got from some other boy. We were overjoyed. She don't have to work. She can tell which horse is gonna finish. Some nights of painkillers.
Craig, the studio, Walter Music Recorders in Hoboken, had lodgings. That was good, because I was almost homeless. But I wasn't depressed about it. I remember feeling free. I had a cell phone and a change of clothes, and what was at hand was all I had to deal with. We were there on Cinco de Mayo, Mexican Independence Day, and Galen made some margaritas to celebrate. After the LP came out, I saw them play in Boston. They were really dynamic, and you got sucked in by their rowdiness. The place was full of Irish Boston dude energy, and I was probably the only girl. I seriously thought I was going to get my ass kicked. And even my husband, who is a big dude, was like, this crowd is drunk and looking for a fight. Bobby, my parents both played clarinet. They'd drilled that old joke into me. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. That ran through my head when we played there with Springsteen during the Bruce Springsteen tribute concert that took place on April 5th, 2007. I was fucking terrified, but we drank a lot of brown whiskey and nailed it. Bruce said, does anybody know the words to Rosalita? Come out tonight. Fortuitously, we talked about covering it instead of Atlantic City in our set that night. So I sang the first verse. It was intense. I remember saying to myself, don't think about what's happening for the next 5 minutes. You can think about it all you want when you get back home. I met Bruce properly about 9 months later, and he was super kind and super supportive. He really understood what we were doing. Franz, the first New York show on the Boys and Girls in America tour was a Sunday night at the Irving Plaza. there was a feature on us in the New York Times, and I thought, wow, we're the biggest draw in New York tonight. It's actually happening. Then Carnegie Hall and Bruce standing in the wings watching us. We got a standing ovation. When we played with him, I danced with Ronnie Spector that night and gave her a little spin. Craig. There's a newness and excitement about Boys and Girls that soaks through that whole record. Everything came together in a perfect storm, and I was experiencing a lot of firsts. That winter, we went to Europe for the first time, and I'm glad I wasn't so young that I took it for granted. He was 33. That summer at Glastonbury, it rained, of course, but I got my wellies and trudged through the mud to see Amy Winehouse. At Heathrow, on the way home, I went into this little HMV that only stocked about 60 titles, and Boys and Girls was one of them. I thought Jesus Christ maybe were actually positioned to do something. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Under the Table and Dreaming by the Dave Matthews Band, 1994. Review summary, a tremendous debut album that indicates the potential for even greater things. Prior to the 1990s, the world had never heard anything like Dave Matthews Band. Sure, there were jam bands such as Fish and even the Allman Brothers Band, but neither of these bands had the sound that Dave Matthews Band developed. After releasing a semi-official live record, Remember Two Things, in 1993, the band's first full-length studio album was released a year later. Under the Table and Dreaming is an excellent debut by a band that kept on growing throughout the 1990s, complete with a full sound to say the least, and pop hooks. Under the Table and Dreaming is one of their poppiest records to date, which can be attested by singles What Would You Say, Satellite, and Ants Marching. To say that the record has pop appeal does not completely define the album, for a great deal of diversity can be found here. Here's a little bit of the song What Would You Say by the Dave Matthews Band.
Tumbling after
us of original sin.
Rip away the tears,
drink a whole two happy years.
You may find a lifetime has passed you by.
What would you say?
Much like its descendant, Crash, Under the Table and Dreaming centers on the concept of freedom, which is especially displayed in Slow Burner, Typical Situation. Everybody's happy, everybody is free, keep the big door open, everyone will come around. Singles What Would You Say and Ants Marching accentuate this as well, with towering violins, saxophones, and a bouncy, carefree feel. The later of these tracks is one of the tracks that made the band famous, and is perfect for live performance due to its potential for expansion and soloing. This is a recurring theme in most of the band's music, for there is just something about Dave Matthews' Band that makes their songs translate so well into live shows. And here's a little bit of that song, Ants Marching, by the Dave Matthews Band.
Changes our thing. The week ends, the week begins. She thinks
Despite Under the Table and Dreaming's blissful feel, there is a good deal of diversity with some darker and more serious tracks. The record's longest track is Warehouse. Is a brilliant song transitioning from an eerie introduction and verse to more pleasurable chorus. The diversity in the track alone is incredible. Dave goes from "See, I'm leaving, this warehouse frightens me, has me tied up in knots, can't rest for a moment, soon I'm going, I'm slipping slow away," to "Leave all the lights on so we can see the black cat changing colors, and we can walk under the ladders and swim as the tide turns you around and around." Rhyme and Reason is the album's darkest and more brutal track, for Dave utilizes this growl-like yell, screaming at times, "My head won't leave my head alone, and I don't believe it will till I'm 6 feet underground." Dave actually even threatens to lose it on "Lover Lay Down," the beautifully ballad of the record. Dave Matthews Band's studio debut says almost all there is to say about the band in just over 60 minutes. From the pleasing opener, "Best of What's Around," to instrumental number 34, this is an excellent record. More importantly, Under the Table and Dreaming gives us the indication that this band is capable of even greater things, which would be achieved in their next few albums. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April 2026 issue of Mojo Magazine. If you're a big Miles Davis fan, I'm going to dedicate the entire hour next week to an article titled "Miles at 100, and then a classic album review of The Rising by Bruce Springsteen. Until then, this is Andy Bomick for Mojo Music saying so long, and keep rocking.